From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in legally distinct Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development. I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steven McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark LaCroix, I too make nice games.
In this episode, we talk to Haley McLean, video game lawyer and min-max cohort, to discuss video game IP law. And so, if everyone is ready... Let's start.
Wow, you really had us on a nice edge there.
Welcome, Haley, to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Before we get started, it's a bit of a small world because we are here based in Minneapolis, and you are not, but you do some work with MinMax, which is a group of content creators here in the city. And so it's kind of cool when we heard you were joining. I was like, you're local, but of course you're not, because MinMax has grown. before we really get into the topic of the day, I want to hear just a hair about what you do with them.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So I came on to MinMax to be a community manager a few years ago now, and then I kind of just sort of fell into like the content creation side, mm-hmm. so I do that a lot too. But I was an intern at Game Informer back in the day in 2016. So I lived in Minneapolis for six-ish months. I loved living there. That's probably the one U.S. city I would live in if I had to choose. I love Minneapolis. So that's where I met Ben Hansen, who is the founder of MinMax over there. So obviously, Game Informer is riddled with layoffs, as you all probably know. Yeah. They recently just got resurrected from the dead, which is nice to hear after GameStop shut them down. So they're back now. But anyway, so Ben was the video, the main video producer there for like a decade. So I met him there, and also like a lot of the other cohorts that I work with now at MinMax, like Leo Vader, stuff like that. I met. He was an intern in the same round of interns as me. Okay. That's kind of how I got to know those folks. And then, you know, fast forward years later, Ben was looking for somebody to run community management. He reached out to me. And then now it's been about 2-ish years since I've been with them, but we just kind of do podcasting, gameplay, streams, all that kind of stuff. We have like 4 or 5 different podcasting shows on any given week. It's all Patreon supported as well. Mm-hmm. So it's completely independent, funded from that model. And yeah, it's great working with them. It just kind of feels like I get paid to just talk about games with my friends. So I'm down to do that. I work in the law all during the day, and then the evening I do MinMax stuff. And they're like, "How are you not tired?" I'm like, "This is fun. Like, what do you mean? It's like the best part of my day."
Cool. I guess it must surprise people that just those two different paths. But I bet just knowing from, you know, there's a lot of indie devs will relate to this. Like, if you have a day job, sometimes you have a ton of energy to do your creative stuff at night because you're not sapped of it during the day, right?
Right.
And it's probably helpful when you have two totally different things that I'm guessing for you are probably both very satisfying.
Yeah, no, like it's kind of like during my law work, all I do is read contracts related to games, and then at nighttime I just play games. So it's like all games, but like two different sides of the brain, like left and right brain styled involvement with games, just kind of cool.
That's nice. That's a whole brain day.
Yeah, that's
incredible.
That is
a
complete brain unit.
We should all be so lucky.
Yeah.
Oof.
So Haley, can you introduce the lawyer side? That is, you know, the bulk of what we're going to be talking about today. What is it exactly you do in law?
Yeah, so I went to law school wanting to be in games law. I actually worked in games journalism for like 5 years, but there's like no jobs. So I was like, okay, how do I stay involved in games in like a reading or writing fashion? So that kind of led me to law school, which I was always interested in. So all my papers in law school were about games, even though my professors hated it. I didn't really care. I still wrote about them. All my classes I took were like, you know, something that would be helpful in a games sort of practice. And I was able to get my job with Boyer right out of law school, which I was super lucky for that. So we have a whole side of our practice that's just dedicated to games. And I represent majority indie game devs. We have like a few publishers that come to us as well. But what we're known for is, you know, trying to be as dev friendly as possible with publisher agreement negotiations, which is getting better and better year by year, which is nice. But, you know, besides that, I also help game devs just get their company set up. They need basic corporation set up like any other tech company, getting all their IP organized into their corporate shell. You know, so say, for example, they worked on something for 5 years and now they're incorporating. We got to move all that IP into the company. And providing education on that and how that operates. And then, you know, if they're bringing on employees, contractors, they're having terms and conditions, privacy policies, if they're getting agreements from other parties that they need to sign, they want me to look at them. But the biggest thing tends to be the publishing agreement review, because if there's one thing a game dev will spend money on, it's the agreement that determines how much money they make for the next 10 years.
Yeah.
So they'll usually get someone to look at that for them.
So in terms of the size of the indie companies or groups of indie developers that you work with, what's the kind of smallest, the largest group, and then the general size of entity that you're working with on a day-to-day?
Yeah, majority, vast majority, 80% are one to two team studios, I would say, with the majority of them being one team, and then hiring like contractors or something like that, maybe to do what they're not, you know, like music composers and stuff. We might have, I always say, like, with the layoffs that are happening with the game industry and how awful that is, the silver lining is they're all just making their own games now, but we don't know it because it's going to take like 5 years for them to come out.
Right.
So it's like a lot of ex-Ubisoft, a lot of ex-EA, a lot of ex, you know, Rockstar, Blizzard, all these like really bigger devs are leaving those jobs and saying, I have all these skills, I know how to use them, I just need my own, you know, vertical slice in the games industry to make my own thing. So that is nice to see, is them split off, make their own corporations, and sort of just go into their basement nooks to work on their projects for 5 years. So every time there's big layoffs, I'm like, wait, there's going to be so many good indies like in 5 years. Just wait, because they're all going to make such good stuff. That or we lose them to like other areas of the industry that don't, you know, churn them out as fast as the games industry seems to.
Such an amazingly optimistic perspective that you get to have with all of that because of the work that you're doing with these game devs. That's so nice.
Yeah, it's really, and you know, I have solicitor client privilege, so I can't talk about any of the projects they're working on, obviously. But it's like, whenever someone's like, oh, like, blah, 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 I'm like, just wait, there's so many good, I can't talk about them yet, but I'm like so excited to be able to share that. I have a unique thing, the fact that I talk about games in my free time too, where a lot of my clients will release games and then I kind of have to like abstain from commenting on them in the commentary side.
All right.
Because it's like, it's like the weirdest bias of all time, because it's like I'm their lawyer, but like it's not like I get anything from the game being successful besides like I'm happy for them, but you still have to disclose it. But then I have to go to them first and ask if I can breach the solicitor client privilege, not breach, but you know, if they have consent to talk about the fact that I'm their lawyer. They always say yes, but I still have to do that first and have it in the right order. So it's kind of a clunky, thing I have to deal with sometimes that I feel like no other lawyer has had to deal with before, but it's still pretty fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not a lot of corporate lawyers like go on, you know, podcasts talk about the cool, like, you know, weird business they're working with.
Yeah, so, divorce lawyers dropping the tea on their drama podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I always joke about this, but like my colleagues who aren't in the game side of our practice would be like, oh, I just got yelled at on a phone call. And I'd be like, I got a game code. I'm like,
nice. Later.
So game devs are like the best clients. They're so sweet. They're so receptive to information, you know, because they're not as knowledgeable about the business legal side of running it. They just know how to make cool games and they just want to be creative and not deal with the businessy stuff. So they kind of, I say, shove all that onto me. That's, I'll deal with all this and go make your cool games. But just like, every single one of my game dev clients, I'm like, I love them to death. They're so chill. And, you know, I've done big M&A stuff with huge multi-million dollar corporations, and the vibes between like an indie dev and a multi-million dollar corp are just completely different.
Right.
Well, it's probably a difference of like stakes and dreams, right?
Yeah.
The balance between those two things.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a big part of, I guess, where we want to start with our questions, which is, I think everyone kind of understands generally, like if they're coming from Jump, it's probably a thing they should pay attention to, IP law in particular. But, and then they have their own kind of understanding as a consumer about intellectual property.
Right.
So what are the sort of areas that that you cover, and what confuses people? What are sort of maybe the top things, the first things you have to tell people, like, okay, I know this, you have this information from your life as a human being, but like, here's the correction to that.
Yeah, I think people get really confused with the different forms of IP. They think it's just all IP, which is technically correct, but you know, there's trademarks, patents, and copyrights, which are all IP, but all vastly different. So sometimes they'll, you know, pre-assume things thinking of trademark when actually they should be thinking of copyright and the rules about copyright. With video games, it's majority copyright. If I had to put them in order, it's probably copyright, trademark, patents, because not that many patents apply to games except for Nintendo filing every effing patent on everything, and they're pissing me off. But I can't stand it. But so, you know, copyright is any kind of literary, music, performance, sort of like a tangible piece of art that you create. So it could be code, music, animations, art asset, text, story, characters, world, gameplay, all these kind of things are copyright. And not only is the game as an end product copyright, so, you know, the, you know, Overwatch is copyrighted, like the full game, but also you could take all of its portions, the sound effect when Tracer shoots her gun, the art asset of Tracer's gun, Tracer herself, her lore background, her character model, the mocap work that went into making her, like all these things are also copyright pieces that sort of get shoved together into one final copyrightable piece as well. Mm-hmm. In terms of indie devs, probably the most common thing I get almost every single time we're incorporating is they don't really understand that when they make IP, they own it themselves personally unless we sign something to move it into the company.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
There's kind of, yeah, there's a presumption that like, well, I'm doing this work for the company, therefore it's flowing in. But you need to sign an IP assignment agreement or something similar, or maybe a contract or agreement that has IP provisions with your own company in order to take the IP that you own personally and move it into the corporate shell, which corporations are almost like pseudo people under the law. They can own property, they can own IP, they can they can get into agreements with other parties, all this kind of stuff. So you actually need to physically move that IP into that shell. And then the earlier you do that, the easier it is, because if it starts having a bunch of value, then you have to worry about taxes and stuff like that. But, you know, you can't transfer in something that's worth $10,000 for a dollar. The, you know, CRA or IRS would say, what the hell, where's our tax on that?
Right.
If you can argue you're in the pre-phase where everything's worth nothing, you can just transfer it in for a dollar and then let the value accumulate while it's inside the corporation and all the value kind of gets housed in there.
So like when you join a game company and as part of your onboarding documents, you get a contract that says anything that I make for the company or on company hardware or software, it is the property of the company. That is essentially the provision that they're making. So on the jump, whatever you're making is owned by that entity.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's only one instance where there's a presumed assignment of copyright, which is an employee-employer relationship. And even then, 99.9% of good employers will get you to sign something anyway. So it's like really clear that what you're doing is getting assigned into the company.
Sure.
But that's the only time where there could be, and this would be like you have to go to court to prove it, right? It's not something that's that easily just said. But that would be the only time where you don't have an agreement, but you could presume that the work you're doing is flowing into the corporation if you're its employee and your employer has asked you to do these specific things. Even still, no lawyer would ever say like no need for agreement. Now they'll say here's your employment agreement. But like with contractors where you're your founder of your own company and you're just doing work, you always need something to move it in. Mm-hmm. That's the number one confusion thing. And you know, they'll get to a point where they're about to sign something with a publisher and the agreement will have something called like representations and warranties, which are, if we strip all the legalese away, it's like I promise that this is true. And, mm-hmm. and you know, if this isn't true, then I'll take all the heat you get for this not being true is kind of what that section's about.
Sure.
So they'll have a section that says, you know, you have a warrant that the company owns all the IP and there'll be no violations of IP infringement if the publisher uses the IP for the purposes that the agreement says. But if they've technically not moved the IP from themselves personally into the corporation, that could theoretically become an issue if, I don't know, say there's an audit or, you know, one of the founders, there's two founders and one of them runs away and says, I don't want to do this anymore and takes all the IP with them and they never assigned it into the company. And now you're violating the publisher agreement because they're saying you're not allowed to use my assets anymore. Bye. Runs away. And the person who stays gets hung up on the reps and warranties there. So it's more of a risk if you have more than one person because mm-hmm. someone could always leave. But that's the number one IP misconception is that like, if I'm doing work for my company, it's going in there. It's like, no, you need to actually sign something that says I hereby assign all right title interest, blah, blah, blah. And you move it into the corporate shell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I have that conversation 4 times a week, I would say, with them, just explaining that concept. And they're always like, oh, okay, cool. And sign the IP assignment. And then it's all housed in there nicely.
I would say this is a particular hang up for indie teams that don't have a company, like a bunch of friends working together and then they're ready to publish the thing, and then they sign one of the unluckiest of them to be the biz dev person to get it all
There's
going.
There's always one.
And then and that person doesn't know what to do, and then like and then, you know, years later, they maybe aren't all living in the same city anymore. Maybe they're not even in contact, and yet they all split the copyright and no one even realizes it.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's not owned by because every, you know, code, every bit of code you write is yours unless you give it away. Like, even if you're writing in a code base. And those things are really hard to track. And it's one of those things where I've looked at contracts and there's always the clause, which is when you assign a license to the work you're doing or you're assigning ownership, it always has a thing in there that says, and you assert that you are able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it isn't always guaranteed that you are able to do that. And the liability is on you if you misrepresent yourself to a publisher that like, oh, you didn't actually get that agreement from all your team. You can't sign on their behalf or whatever. So I think that's a misconception. People get hung up by that on a technical sense. How often does that, I want to say, actually come up? Like, how often do people, because it can be very scary if it comes to it. Some disgruntled person or a relationship falls apart. There can be lots of drama there. Does that happen a lot, or is that just a constant fear we all have? And of course, we should all be doing it right, regardless of how often it really happens, right?
Yeah. As soon as money comes up, as soon as the game starts making money and things aren't organized, that's when everything gets so much more confusing. Yeah. Not that everyone suddenly becomes greedy Scrooge McDuck and is like, I'm going to take all the money. It's just that things become more confusing and you have a lot more promises to make as soon as the game starts commercializing well. Sure. So if you have an indie that not many people are downloading, it hasn't made that much money, no one's really going to go, is your IP all organized? Where's all your IP? Let's make sure everything's organized. But if you got a sleeper hit, like that Schedule 1 weed game, I wonder if those are the kind of games that I'm like, I guarantee that IP is all over the place, super messy, because they weren't anticipating making millions of dollars in a month, like selling as many as those. And it's so much harder to backtrack and go try to fix it, because now everything's worth millions of dollars. So now the IRS is going, what are you moving? Oh, Schedule 1, the game, into a corporate shell? Okay, give us X percentage of that transfer amount, because it's worth this much money because you've made this much money.
Right.
But if they had done that pre-release, you know, 2 years ago, 1 year ago, they could have transferred everything in for a dollar. Everyone been cool. All the money would be in the corporation and they could split it via dividends or pay everybody an employee salary or something like that. That tends to be, as soon as money is introduced, it's like everything gets a lot more complicated, and it's nice to have everything organized up until that point. But what's hard for games is you don't know if it's going to be a random crazy sleeper hit. Like Among Us made barely any money until COVID hit, you know, that was, it wasn't that popular. And then all of a sudden it had this extreme boom in popularity. And, you know, you'd hope that everything's organized before then, because all of a sudden then it's, instead of just, can you sign this, move the IP in? Sure. It's okay. My lawyer's going to read this IP assignment and then I'll sign it to move it in. And then it's like, okay, now I want triple the rev share, blah, 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 which is in their right to negotiate more now, right? It has more value, but for the one biz dev person who's in charge of all that, they're going to be like, oh my God, I wish I handled this in 2022 instead of right now.
Yeah.
Right. Where it's all over the place.
So I guess the question that follows on from that is, there's a ton to worry about. What do people worry too much about? Like, what in this area, what are people just like distracted by that is not as important, particularly when it comes to games?
From a legal side point, that's kind of a tough one, because my anxiety-ridden brain is like, everything's important, just get it done so we don't both have to think about it anymore. I often say I monetize my anxiety by becoming a lawyer, because my job is to think of everything that could ever go wrong and then draft it so that we have a procedure for if that happens.
That makes so much sense.
I would say, you know, and everything here is just informational. Like, I would say not incorporating sooner can sometimes be kicked down the line a little later than needed for some instances. Not that anyone listening feels like they need to go incorporate right now, and this is all informational, legal information, nothing's advice or whatever, but you should probably, if you're starting to think that you're going to be contracting with other parties, you're worried about taking on liability in your personal capacity, your IP is a little bit all over the place, maybe you have a few different contractors haven't signed anything, not incorporating and moving everything into like a nice shell might be kicked down the road too late sometimes. But in the exact same way that like not getting all the IP assigned into one specific location could get kicked down the road sometimes too.
Sure.
But you know, that's just the reality of game development, you know, especially in the indie scene, is that and especially even the last like 2 or 3 years, such so much more sophisticated indie games are getting made right now. Like they have the budgets to have crazy soundtracks by like the composer of Final Fantasy VII or something. You're like, what? How did they get them? They have, you know, the artist from XYZ and all these things. And I'm like, how are they getting those people? And it's, you know, maybe they won't get a lawyer to check an agreement when they sign it. And then they kind of come to them a little bit down the line and say, is this okay? That sometimes happens, which is always the worst. You know, we'll get people who signed a publishing deal and then the game will start making money. They come to us to re-review it and check it. And it'll have language that essentially says, like, they own the game IP now or something like that. You know, like, did you know you were signing the game IP? And they go, no, I didn't know that. And I'm like, yeah, the publisher owns your game right now. And they're like, what? And they just got excited. They had a deal cross their path. Like, yeah, I don't know if you've ever, like, when you go to GDC, everyone's just trying to get a publishing deal, right? Like, that's the energy of GDC a lot of times. So if you feel special to get the one offer, sometimes people just sign it and go, yippee, here comes the advance. I can't wait. And they don't really get someone to read it. That can be the other thing. I would almost always suggest if this is the thing that details how much money you're making for the next decade, like spend the whatever amount, 1,000, 2,000, whatever, depending on how complex it is, to get someone to review it for you, because that could change literally what percentage of money you get back in the long run, slash if you get to own your IP when you walk away from the deal as well and do whatever you want with it after.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So it sounds to me like you really should try to be proactive about a lot of things related to legality or law. Just to cover your back, because as a person who a lot of law stuff kind of flies over my head, definitely am somebody who will kind of just fly by the seat of their pants and not really pay too much attention to it, and I know that's a problem. But hearing you say that, like, you know, you should probably be concerned about these things because such and such can happen. It's definitely a wake up call.
That phrase, the next 10 years.
Yeah,
I think I'm guessing that's something that you say a lot to your clients to make it real for them.
Yeah, you know, it's not so much something I say to my clients, more like people who could become my clients in the future, you know? Sure. Like once they're with me, we're like, we're completely in it. We're talking about the deal. And something else I like about where I work is we work on a flat fee model. So before I worked at my law firm, when I was still in law school, I worked for a law clinic that essentially let us provide legal services for only $100. And it was all new tech startups in my province of Nova Scotia. And what I loved about that model was they gave us $100 and then they could talk to us for 10 hours about something they didn't understand if they wanted, no additional fees accrued.
Nice. Instead of doing it every 7 minutes, you get billed a certain amount of
exactly.
money.
So I loved that like educational side. So part of the reason why I like Voyer a lot is we do flat fee whenever possible. So if someone wanted a contract agreement template, it's like, here's how much it costs, but you can email me as much as you want. We can have as many calls as you want. You can ask as many questions. And the ticker doesn't like go on for any of that. So it's like, if you want to say, can we have a call and you explain every provision like I'm five? And I'm like, sure. Because I kind of like that part. It makes my days go by a lot quicker. And it's the most rewarding part. It's just like explaining things so that when they go out and they're getting people to sign that contract agreement template, they're using it effectively. And it will make my job easier down the line when I go to look at all the templates they've used and everything's executed correctly, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it ends up saving everybody's time. Yeah, I tend to warn, you know, I've given some talks about publishing agreements and stuff like that in the game dev space. And it's just, if there's one thing you want to get checked, have it be the thing that determines what you get paid.
Right.
And, you know, and the art that you've worked, you know, sometimes people are working on their projects for five years. I think Blueprints that just came out, it was like an 8-year game, nine years or something, that person was working on it. It's like, do you really want to not sign the thing that details all the money you'll make from the thing you worked on for 8 years, like just get someone to look at it really, like even quickly, and like tell you if it's just the overlaying stuff, that kind of stuff. So I would say the majority of what I do these days is basic corporate like setup companies, but also publishing agreement review.
Okay.
And maybe something else I'll plug too is we just recently did a publishing agreement market report at my law firm. So we've looked at over 100 publishing agreements in the last 5 years, and we essentially anonymized all the data and made it so that we just had the averages for all these publishing deals so that indie devs, but also publishers too, right, can know the market and know if they're underselling or overselling or that kind of thing. So That's at indiegamepublishing.com, and that's just free information online as well. So that'll have things like the average rev share, the average advance that companies can get, if they have sequel rights, how long an average term of the agreement is, all that kind of stuff. So we've gotten a lot of really positive reception from that, from devs who can't afford lawyers at this point, but at least can look at that and say, all right, from an empirical sense, for these 100 some odd agreements, the average rev share was 50, I think it's like 58 or something percent. I can get the exact thing so I don't just sound like I'm making stuff up. So yeah, agreement with an advance, the average rev share was 58.2% for developers. And they can say, oh, right now I'm getting offered 40. I'm getting, you know, screwed right now. I shouldn't try to argue for higher. So even if I can't be in the room with them to help them with those kind of negotiations, at least they have some free information somewhere online. Mm-hmm. And we've gotten publishers reach out to us too to say like, oh, this is nice. Like, we didn't realize that we were asking for something that no other publisher asked for, so we stopped asking for that because we want to be more in line with our deals with other publishers of similar size of us. It's a lot of, you know, indie and double A. This wouldn't really concern AAA games at all, like Rockstar or Blizzard or anything that. It's just like the smaller devs, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Hello, dear listener. But especially you, dear listener, who is on our Discord channel.
Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. Aren't we addressing the dear listener who is not yet on our Discord channel?
I'm trying to make the Discord, the listeners who are on Discord feel more special, so the people who aren't on Discord feel compelled to join the Discord.
We have to establish...
I'm sorry. I didn't read the memo.
We have to establish the FOMO.
Right. So Discord's really cool. Join us on the Discord, nicegames.club/Discord. You can chat with us. You can chat with other fellow listeners and have a good time. Definitely beneficial for people who listen to the show because you just get to provide your voice to the show and we comment on those things as well. So, listener who is on our Discord, thank you for being a part of our community. Thank you for speaking up and talking about all of the different topics that we bring up on the show. Thank you for communicating with us and communicating with other people in the Discord and the community. We very much appreciate it.
Now, Stephen, were it that I would want such thanks from you.
Right.
What must I do?
Well, you need to go to nicegames.club/Discord. You could join in the Discord and be part of this lovely thanking that I'm giving to you right now.
And if Stephen's thanks are not enough, typically after interviews, we at the person who we interviewed and when we launched the episode,
right?
And there's potential chance to talk, and we just got permission from our interviewee, Haley, that she's okay with it.
Yeah.
So if you want to talk at Haley and have continued the discussion that you just that we're having, that is a good opportunity.
Yeah. Now we're recording this after we recorded the full episode. Listeners have only heard half of the insight so far.
Guess what? It gets better.
By the end, you will have so many follow-up questions.
Right. Mm-hmm. So thank you, dear listener, for providing those follow-up questions on the Discord, nicegames.club/Discord.
Okay, so you got into publishing agreements. That's a big area. So let's dig into each of those points, I think, because I think when developers go to GDC, they feel like that they want an agreement, right? Like that we're all desperate, and we have so little information about what else is there that we feel like definitely it's like a seller's market in that case. I mean, I don't know who the buyer and seller in this metaphor is necessarily because it's agreement. But I think with the like posting that information and making sure people understand both on both sides, you understand it's a competitive market on both sides, right? Like if you have a good game, ideally you want publishers to compete for it. And so you want to make sure that you can evaluate what their offer is. So let's talk about each of those things. I think the one of the things you mentioned was about like IP ownership. From my background, prior to games, I worked in film, and those kinds of agreements are almost 100% ownership. You sell your IP pretty much universally. In games, that's true in the AAA space. In indie, my understanding and my experience has been that you almost never sign that over unless you do it by mistake. So I want to hear more about that. Like, what do developers assume when they come to you? And what do publishers assume? And what is the value of that licensing versus ownership? because I haven't heard a publisher that I've talked to ever even bring it up as something they're interested in, which is unusual for a creative industry.
Mm-hmm. So, totally. And it's interesting compared to film because there's so sometimes we'll even get this is obviously a film contract that you just changed the definition from film to game.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is not industry standard at all. So we actually have data on that. So with an agreement with an advance, 96.4% of agreements had developer always maintaining ownership of the IP.
Okay.
So that's, and then agreements without an advance and then console only agreements, 100% of the time, mm-hmm. they always own the IP. So we're starting from a place where it is extremely, 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 I fight for this hardest of all things for the dev, worst comes to worst, the parties hate each other, they're in court, they're screaming at each other. Developer gets to walk away with their game, mm-hmm. I think is like the bare minimum that I would like to push for. Again, this is information, not legal advice, blah, blah, blah. You know, I just have to say that, but that's what I like to push for the hardest. What I sometimes see is agreements that detail, you assign everything to the publisher, and when the agreement terminates, they sign it back unless the developer breaches the agreement, which is like, I'm kind of like, I don't love that. Even, you know, the developer will say, oh, but I'm not going to breach it. I'm like, everyone thinks they're not going to breach it until they breach it. Or, you know, they might have some really broad language that has to do with non-disparagement. And they're like, mm-hmm. you can never, you know, say anything that would like hurt the sale of the game. And maybe that publisher is very anti some political statement and the developer is pro it. They're on their own personal socials talking about whatever they want to talk about. The publisher's like, hey, this is breaches our NDA. You breached the agreement. Now we own the game. That's never happened in my experience, but that's my anxiety brain going to worst case scenario, sure, right? Yeah. So I don't like to see that. And then the other kind of side of it too is I always like to see that when the agreement terminates, if the publisher has made any game IP, so publishers will often do marketing, localization, or porting. Like those tend to be the only services that the publishers will offer, along with just distributing the game on platforms. They might have connections at Nintendo and Sony and Microsoft to get it on the game on those platforms quicker. But sometimes indie studios don't have the breadth to be able to localize it into Mandarin or port it to Switch or whatever. So right. the publisher will offer those services and that'll be part of its experience. If they're making all those assets, it's also not very common for developers to know that they own those assets, even if they're completely incorporated into the game. They'll kind of assume, well, they translated it to French, but I own that because it's my game. It's like, well, no, they translated it. That's their translation of the work. Can they use it after termination? Probably not, because it's so incorporated into the game itself that if they were to post the entire text of the game script online, I'd be like, that's probably infringement, even if they made that asset, you know, because it's still wholly incorporated to the original text of the game. But I always try to push for the publisher assigning everything they've ever made in relation to the game to developer upon termination, because it's just going to sit on a USB anyways if you don't want to keep, you know, like if the agreement's ending, the licenses are terminating, why should you own the French translation of the game you will never, ever use again?
Right.
Like, bring it back to the developer. Maybe that changes some other thing that we negotiate. Maybe they'll say, okay, but the term is one extra year if we're going to do that. It's like, okay, sure, if everyone's cool with that. But I never try to say, like, why should you own all the marketing assets you make for the game? Because as soon as you don't have a license to the game, you can't use those ever again. That's kind of dumb. Like, let's just give them to the developer. So then when the developer leaves, they get to leave with all the ports that the publisher made, all the localizations, all the marketing materials. If they cut together an awesome trailer, they don't have to remove that from YouTube once the agreement's terminated or something like that. All those kind of things tends to be something that the publisher doesn't really think of because it's not in their interest. So not on them to contract draft for the developer's benefit, right? But that's why it's good to have a lawyer look at it, because then I can fight for those things that I think like the developer should have, but I can see why the publisher wasn't like, and you get everything we ever make, because they wouldn't why would they put the effort into saying that? It doesn't help them. So that can be a common thing that once you point that out to developer, they're like, oh my god, they're making like 5 localizations, I want to own all of that. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, give that to them. Because you imagine having it in all those languages and they have to rip it off of Steam and all the languages once the agreement's done. Like, right. That would just be so annoying.
It's such a, I mean, it really feels kind of King Solomon, where you actually end up cutting the baby in half. Yeah. You end up with two halves. You have the things that you made, but they are no longer valuable. It's just complete gutting of an artistic piece.
it matches up exactly with when you're working on a team. It's the same thing, like who contributed what. It's just that it's just different entities who do the creating. But the issue is exactly the same, right?
Yeah.
I want to pat myself on the back a little bit because when we did Widget Satchel, we had a Japanese publisher and they did the Japanese localization.
Yeah.
And I made sure to ask, like, because they only had publishing rights in Japan.
Right.
And I had to make sure to, like, double check, like, say, hey, can we use this in the, you know, international versions? And they were really cool about it, but like I had to make sure to get that agreement because I was insistent on one code base. So like,
yeah.
We wouldn't have been able to release it elsewhere if I didn't have that agreement.
Well, thank goodness you did that.
Well, now the game didn't sell enough for anyone to care about it, so it's
still.
But I think what's interesting about the publisher agreements that people, they put so much effort into those things, and then the things they don't notice as much or don't think enough about or think there's boilerplate for, the boilerplate that the publisher is just like, you know, whatever, because they're not necessarily interested in everyone's interested in the game doing well, but the publisher is not interested past that, even if they're super friendly and like you.
Right.
So champion is really, really valuable. And when it comes to those like marketing assets and localization things, like, yeah, our publisher was like, yeah, you can have it, even though like it had value. Like it's interesting how cool they were with it. Do you ever find that publishers will fight back on that, not because those materials have any value to them should the agreement lapse or expire, but to keep the developer on with them for future projects or sequels without having that necessarily, you know what I mean? Because it would be so costly to untangle that relationship. Or is that not something, a motivation you see from publishers?
Not so much specifically that as a motivation, but it is common to have right of first negotiation for sequels in agreements. That's very common. So what that means is before they make game two, and it might not even be a sequel, it could be, we usually define it as sequel, prequel. There's so many words for derivatives of games.
Yeah.
Sequel, prequel, HD remaster, remake, like all these things. If they want to make one of those things, they have to go to the publisher first. Mm-hmm. And there's either a right of first negotiation, which is just the parties sit down. Maybe they have 30 days to talk about it. They try to come to a mutual agreement to work together, and if they can't come to good terms, then the developer can walk away and go work with someone else. Or you could have a right of last call. Why can't I remember it? I only read this every day. Right of first negotiation and right of last call, I think the second one is called, which is essentially if a third party comes to developer and says, I want to make the sequel for this, I will give you 60% rev share and $600,000 advance, and that's their offer. They have to take that deal to your first publisher and say, can you match this or do better? And if they can do that, then they have to work with the publisher.
Oh, interesting.
So that's the other deal. So it's kind of like they get first call on at least talking to you or getting to match a deal that another party has granted you. So that's kind of how that operates. And those are quite common. Those are in most agreements that we see. Whether or not that lasts a long time after the agreement's done, like usually it'll be during the term and for like 1 year thereafter or 2 years thereafter or something like that. Essentially, they kind of want to be, if the game does well, it's like they're getting rewarded for being part of that success early on. So they get first dibs on potentially working with you again.
Sure.
But, you know, as long as if you only have a right of first negotiation and the parties sit down and chit chat and they're like, hey, listen, we don't want to work with you anymore, the publisher can't go, but you have to. Yeah, you have to work with, like, it's not forcing you to do anything. It's essentially just forcing that sit down to happen to at least have the potentiality for the parties to work together.
Yeah.
So that's the first right of first negotiation. Right of first refusal. That's what the other one's called. Sorry, I just jumped in my head at the last bit. So that'll be common.
The idea of basically signing up to make more product under one publisher is pretty commonly known, or at least tacitly known among people when it comes to music albums or book deals, movies as well. And clearly it seems like people have been mixing up the or using boilerplate for movies and other forms of art when they come to you and say, hey, we have an idea of a contract, here you go, but it's not for games.
Yeah.
Are there other, especially when it comes to that kind of clause, is there any distinction or major difference between other forms of media like books or movies or music versus games, especially considering games use all of these forms of media in the single entity that is a game?
Yeah, I would say the licensing language is always super different. With IP, there's assignment and license, which sounds similar, but they're really different. I had a teacher teach me this like in 2018, and I still think about the way she described it. But it's like, if I have a mug, I could sell you my mug, and that's the assignment of the mug, and you can go home and do whatever you want with that mug. That's your mug now. Or I could grant you a license to my mug, and you're only allowed to drink tea in it. And if you drink coffee in it, then I'm going to sue you.
That's like, breach of contract.
That's kind of like it, that's the bare roots of it. You're getting a permission to use the IP for a certain purpose versus assignment. It's like, this sucker's yours. Have fun. See ya. Like, selling it to you. Mm-hmm. So in these publishing agreements, it's always licensing, right? Because I just kind of talked about how mm-hmm. the publisher shouldn't be owning the IP, so we shouldn't be assigning it over or selling it to them.
Right.
So it'll be the developer granting them certain rights to use the game for only the things that they should be using it for. So like, if we saw, like, one time I saw language that was like, you hereby grant the publisher a license to distribute the game on all platforms, including for free if it wants or something. Oh. And I'm like, that's literally the opposite of what this whole deal is. So yeah. I was like, that's insane. And I pointed that out. They're like, oh, we just had that in from another deal. I was like, if you had signed this, they could have released the game for free tomorrow and totally been no problem. And wow. They're like, oh no. But that's just because they just had someone in marketing write the contract, right? Like, that's mm-hmm. kind of very common too, is like non-lawyers drafting up these agreements, and then I look at them and I'm like, oh my god, it's gonna take 10 times longer than what I thought. But what's super super common in even agreements from other lawyers who might just not be in the game space as much is making sure that the elements of the agreements that are exclusive, so only the publisher is allowed to do these things and no one else, is the only the things that should be allowed to be exclusive. Mm. So for example, if the developer is granting a license to the publisher, what I would like to see is they have an exclusive license to publish it and distribute it on the platforms during the term. So the only thing that they're allowed to do is release it on, you know, platforms, let's say that's defined as PlayStation and Switch or something, and Steam. Mm-hmm. So those are the three platforms they're allowed. So they have an exclusive license. No one else in the world is allowed to distribute the games on those three platforms during the term. And if someone else does that, it's a breach of the agreement, because fair enough. Like, why all of a sudden is some other publisher allowed to sell the game at the same time on Steam? That would piss me off too. Yeah. So that makes sense. And then they have a non-exclusive license, aka anyone else could use this, but theoretically, like, really it's just them and the developer using this to use all the underlying game IP to market it, say, for example, or to create derivative works only to create ports of the game or something like that. Because they shouldn't care that, you know, say, for example, developers marketing their game on their own social media, or maybe they hire a consulting company that helps them market, that posts their TikToks or something, gets them on TikTok phases. They shouldn't care about that if the only thing they want to be exclusive is just selling the game somewhere online. Sure. So what we often see is the licensing is like, a developer hereby grants publisher an exclusive license to sell, copy, distribute, develop, market, promote, blah, blah, blah. And they list all these verbs. And I'm like, that's not true, because I've had agreements where essentially it was a violation for the developer to make the game, because they granted the publisher an exclusive license to develop the game. Oh. They were chucking verbs in there to try to be as exhaustive as possible. Yeah. And I'm like, you know, right now you making the game is breaching the agreement. And he was like, what? And I was like, yeah, well, they didn't even think it. Like, they wanted him to make the game, right? Yeah, they just were ignorant to the way that licensing works. But essentially, a lot of times I have to go in there and gut the license to be like, here's the one exclusive part, and then here's everything you're allowed to do that's non-exclusive, so long as it's for the purposes of this agreement, aka marketing it, porting it, mm-hmm. distributing it, that kind of thing. And they almost never come back with questions with like fights about that, because if it was so erroneously described, then usually they take my licensing language and use it in the future. Because sometimes I'll revisit a publisher that I'll negotiated with like a year prior, and they like are using my template. And I'm like, oh, cool. They kept using my language. That's kind of nice. I'm almost like, nice. That's great. I'm like happy to see it, because it means that if they worked with other developers who didn't have me, at least they're like getting a form of my language in there that's a bit more accurate and not misclassifying how the licensing situation should work. So like, some, I remember I told that to somebody, they're like, aren't you pissed they're using their language? I'm like, not really, at least it's out in there and it's correct now.
It ends up helping people in a way that I think is really good. It's actually really fascinating to hear that, like, from both angles of the publisher developer agreement, a lot of these these wrongdoings are kind of happening, but like accidentally, because like people just don't understand law enough to know what they're doing. But they're like, well, we got to make a contract.
So no one's really out to get anyone.
Yeah.
It's because I think when you're on the developer side, you, even when you're working with an indie publisher, you imagine they've got all their ducks in a row.
Right.
Yeah.
They are just as clueless as you are.
Yeah.
It's also so fascinating to hear that a lot of the, I think of legalese as being complicated ways to describe things that you want, but it's so fascinating to also hear how a very valuable piece, and one that is some seems to be the most valuable, is defining what things aren't and what you don't want.
Right.
Because and that being the thing that people forget to articulate as part of a definite, like there's a definite, you can define things by what they are, but also define them by what they are not. And it's so interesting to hear that it is more skewed 50-50 or at least than one would think.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, at least when I went to law school, there's a big shift trying to get away from legalese language and just be more plain in drafting, because ultimately we want everyone who reads this to understand what's going on. If it's confusing or not really clearly indicative of the relationship, then it's a bad agreement, I think. But more antiquated lawyers like to use that verbose language, I think. Low-key, this is my personal opinion because it makes them feel smart. And I'm like, if we can write this so that someone, you know, it's still going to be legally effective and have obligation language and meet all the checkboxes of a good contract and be effective, but someone who doesn't know law could read it and say, okay, I know what rights I have right now. Like, that's, you're supposed to read that and know so no mistakes happen.
A very clear difference between specific and complex when it comes to language. And I think both like there's intelligence in how elegant something specific and clear can be. But a lot of times people think, oh, complex, that's the smart one. Yeah. I use big words.
Well, I want to get your opinion on something then related to that, because one of the things that I've dealt with contracts in a number of fields for a long time. So I have like a working layperson's understanding. So I also have, I'm one of those people who like has to stop myself from having the confidence of like writing it all myself. I have to like check myself for that because I have a lot of experience, but I have to remember I'm not actually an expert in these subjects.
Sure.
But one of the things that I've seen in contracts that I've worked with recently is clauses that say, you know, any ambiguity here is should be interpreted in good faith with the sort of like plain language intention. I'm not sure exactly how it's phrased, but the idea is that a contract, and this is what I understand it, it's not a piece of programming, right? Like as technical as it can be, no English phrase can be fully unambiguous.
Sure.
And I think it's hard for people when you, because you feel like it's just enumerating an agreement. And that you once, you know, if you're in a meeting for 5 hours and you fully agree on everything, the contract should just enumerate that. And so so sometimes I've seen these clauses that just say like, hey, if there's a thing in there that's just obviously technically weird that we discover later, but we, you know, we'll just deal with it. So I kind of want your opinion on that, because that sort of invites, you know, you gotta adjudicate that in some process later on. If the contract, if you don't follow the contract like it's a very specific piece of programming, how does that move away from legalese and maybe that sort of understanding that like maybe if a comma is misplaced, you're not going to get, you know, hanged by that. But then who's to decide what that comma meant if the contract doesn't?
Yeah,
ambiguity is like the worst thing you want in a contract, because if there's ambiguity and the parties agree what it meant, then we're fine, right? Then everyone just goes, okay, sounds good. But if there's ambiguity and the parties disagree on what the intention is, then you're going to court and arguing, and the judge is trying to, you know, essentially determine the intention of the parties external from the parties themselves, because the parties are disagreeing on what the actual intention was.
Yeah. Sure.
They teach us about, there's like the $1 million comma case they tell us about in law school, where somebody, I wish I could remember the structure of the sentence, but essentially if they had moved the comma to a different word, it would have meant that they would have saved $1 million in issue. But the way that the sentence was structured is like where the comma was, the court determined that they had to pay them $1 million, and everyone called it the $1 million comma. Yeah. I'm sure if you Google $1 million comma case court, it'll come up, but they taught us about that in law school to essentially scare us into being like, when you read it, you have to think about be the confused person reading this, trying to solve the problem that you're thinking ahead for. How would they read it? That's kind of the way that I like to draft. A super common one. And, you know, the more that issues, what's kind of nice about being in law for more than a few years too, I'm in my third year practice only, is I'm learning more and more anecdotal things that just happen naturally while I'm working with my clients that now I contract draft to avoid moving forward to. And it's kind of like just capturing all those, oh, I remember that one time when they wanted to audit and that was such a pain. So I'm just going to add in here that blah, blah, blah. You know, now I always add in my audits that you can attend them via digital meetings instead of in person, because who wouldn't want that? And now we don't have to fly to Florida or something to just to do an audit.
Right.
So adding in those little things, because I remember that one client who was like, I don't want to go to Florida to do the audit. This sucks. And I was like, now I think about them every time I draft an audit, right? Because I'm like, that person hated going to Florida. So now that my other clients will have this. Mm-hmm. It's also kind of nice to grab those kind of things so that everything's super clear, because obviously that in that instance, that publisher wanted to be kind of annoying and didn't want the audit to happen. So when they said, can we do it digital only? They were like, no, the agreement says, doesn't say that. So it has to be in person. So then it's like, oh, and you know, so now if we had that, you could attend by digital, that person probably would have saved $5,000 in flights and all that unnecessary stuff. Going there.
That's a cool parallel with game dev teams too. Cause that's one of the best parts about working on a game dev team, especially one with varying levels of experience, is you get to have the archaic wisdom from mistakes past brought to the rest of the group.
Yeah.
I just collect those like little thought bubbles in my head and impose them into every agreement that I draft to try to always avoid those problems for sure.
Yeah, I find it really interesting that a lot of past experience can still be valuable. So even Mark, even though you're not an expert in law, like you could still use that experience to like help you understand and communicate what you're trying to get from things in a way that I think is really valuable.
I've hired a lawyer to do a contract, and it turns out I actually knew all of this already.
Yeah.
But like I didn't have the confidence to proceed. So like part of me could decide it was a waste of money, but part of me would be like, no, like all I have is folk wisdom.
Right.
Like it just happened to, I just happened to know what I was talking about here, but like I can't, you have to, that confidence has a lot of value.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah.
And so I guess maybe a natural follow on question from that is, and I imagine your bias is to like, just let us handle this, but what are the kinds of things, or maybe the scale of a contract or a league, or even just a clause that you would be comfortable with someone who is, you know, a layperson, either figuring out themselves or making adjustments themselves. Like you can help draft an agreement, but then the parties want to make some changes. Like, when does it start getting the sort of do-it-yourselfness that a lot of indie developers train themselves on? How much do you allow for that? As I guess my question, maybe independent of your practice, but just as general, person on the street advice.
I would say that kind of how I deal with it now is I sometimes get that where somebody will send me an agreement and say, I drafted this, can you just make sure it's good? And I'll say, and they'll send me like a 30-page agreement. And it's like, I know what it's for, but it has, you know, and I'll say, so listen, this is going to take me 8 hours, or I have a template I already drafted that I have to change two things in and I could get this to you for a flat fee of $500. Yeah. I was like, which do you want me to do? And they're like, oh, your template. So it's like, you know, it's just, you know, it's also a matter of resources. Like with law, with transactional law, which is what I deal with, like temp presidents are so key. So past agreements that I've read that I can call on to look at the language, and the fact that I work for a firm that has accumulated such a large number of publishing agreements specifically is so beneficial, because I essentially have a master doc now. I look at them so frequently. Mm-hmm. I have a master doc of like all my favorite provisions and like, oh, that one we got from redacted publisher who's kind of big, who has a big team of lawyers. Look how they wrote their audit. Like, that's so smart. Zionk, like taking that and putting it in my template. So accumulating those kind of things over time it's not just the skills and being good at contract negotiation and like contract drafting, because that is a skill inherently. But in the same way that like a coder who's been coding for 10 years has more skill than someone who's been coding for 1 year. It's like they've done it longer. They have the skills. They're quicker at it.
Right.
So there's that element. But also just the fact that we have a database of previous agreements that I can pull on I kind of have a base publisher agreement template that I have that gets me 90% of the way a lot of time. And I can sort of fill in the gaps if I have a publisher coming to me wanting to draft a publishing agreement, it's going to take 1/10 as much time to start with my template and show it to them and say, what more do you want? And we add that in than them drafting their own thing to try to save time and money. Because I'm like, I'm going to have to change so much of this. Like, number one, like, it's missing this, this, that, you know, just the kind of thing that you only know when you've looked at something 100 times. And it's just like that, you kind of can't learn it other than that. Cause I remember the first few times I was, you know, reviewing publishing agreements, I was leaning heavily on my boss, Kellen, at our firm, who, you know, now I'm off the leash. I'm able to just do what I want because I've looked at a lot more. Mm-hmm. But, you know, relying him because he's looked at publishing agreements for 10 years. So he taught me. So I have that skill coming from him. And now me having looked at a lot of them, I think it's not just a matter of having your law degree and like being called to the bar, but also wanting to hire somebody who does just this in the same way you wouldn't hire like a tax attorney to look at your publishing agreement. Like I couldn't do your tax law at all. Like if someone was like, here's my tax law, I'd be like, what the hell is this? I don't know how to do this. It's like you'd want to hire a specialist to do the specific thing you want to do. And that's why there's so many niche areas of law. Like you could quite literally practice law for anything, environmentalism, you know, all like corporate, criminal, all these privacy law, there's all these different facets. So you wouldn't want to hire a privacy lawyer to do your criminal law or vice versa. So it's the same kind of logic there as well for you yourself thinking you can do it versus like somebody in a completely different field trying to do something else.
Yeah. Sure. Anecdotally, I have a couple friends who went to law school who do very different forms of law, and even their day-to-day experience of what they do and how they talk to people is vastly different between their fields. I was curious actually, because you are able now have a template and you have kind of modular pieces of language, what scenarios, if you can say, what scenarios make you veer the most off template? Because like it just does not, it is just unique enough of a situation that you can't really go change two things and you're done.
It's usually if another party is sending us their template and I can't just be like, can I use mine? They're like, no.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'll sometimes get like, I'm vast majority developer side, like for every publisher client I have 100 game devs. It's just like way more game devs are seeking out introductory corporate advice and IP advice. Mm-hmm. Whereas publishers tend to either already have their template done / they're not looking to update it.
Sure.
So if a developer is coming to me and essentially saying, I just got this agreement from this publisher, can you review it? I'll look at it and I'll go, oh, this is going to take forever. I wish I could just say, let's start with mine. But the publisher is going to say, who the hell are you? No, like, here's our template that we use internally, which is fair enough. So what I'll have to do is go in and edit their template, you know, with track changes on and essentially show them exactly what I'm changing. I like to insert comments and say, like, the reason I'm changing this isn't just because I'm a B word. I'm like doing it because I want the blah, 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 which is called interest-based negotiation. You know, you always want to give a reason to why you're changing something, not just be like, no.
Yeah.
Moving on.
You're stating your intent behind the change in order to align with the intent of the publisher and the intent of the developer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But sometimes we'll get some real stinky agreements. I'm like, this one sucks. And I just have to, like, the time it takes, it kind of sucks because the amount kind of goes onto the developer for, like, me fixing the publisher's template, which I kind of hate. So something that we often do, too, is, like, we build in an advance for them to pay them for the legal costs they spent on me fixing their template. Is we try to negotiate for that. They don't always love that. And they go, no, take this out. And we go, okay, we tried. Let's see. But, you know, it's if it took like, you know, 20 hours for me to take this agreement into something that the parties can sign because it was like something they found on Google and they refused to use my template to start, then it's like, okay, well, now we have an actually solid template that you guys could probably use moving forward. So it's almost kind of like I drafted it for them, but not really. But they're the ones who are going to use this template more than once. So why don't you give the publisher an advance of $2,000 and then we'll call this a day and move forward. And sometimes they say, yeah, sure, that seems fair. And they're fine with that. So trying to build into that negotiation, because I hate to see me spending all this time fixing the publisher's template and the developer pays for it all, even though they're getting protected. But, you know, and I'm drafting for their benefit, not the publisher's benefit. I'm making sure that everything is developer friendly and stuff like that. But that does happen quite frequently. It's like not even just that it's you know, there'll be spelling errors. The sections are all messed up and numbered wrong. So I have to spend time even just fixing like the numbering, which I tend not to even bill for because it's like, this just sucks. I don't want to bill for fixing the formatting. I'll just spend an hour and fix it and then start drafting. But those kind of situations, I always try to be like, I have this really good template that you guys use. You want it? And they're like, no. And I'm like, damn it. So then we go back to square one.
Well, there's two things in there that really hit me. One is that it really validates and reiterates the point you made earlier about the types of law, right?
Yeah.
Like you're saying, like, you know, like, you work in video games, but you also mainly represent indie developers, and you have represented indie publishers, and you have a broader experience outside of that, but your main focus is X. And so that's where your expertise is. And so it's not just important to find the right type of lawyer, but the right use case. Like, what do you need a lawyer for? Find a lawyer who does that specifically, if you can. That I think is really interesting, because like you say, if you get a different template that you're not familiar with or has different provisions or comes from a different like literary tradition almost, you know, like that, that just makes it more difficult for everybody because law isn't a universal language. The second thing that really hit me, you said it a bit ago, which is the sort of yoink of it all, where you said like, oh, this is a clause I see. This is an instance I saw from another contract. I'm going to yoink that and put that in my agreement. I'm going to take my template upward. I'm going to offer it up to somebody else so they can use it. I don't mind. What I find fascinating is that brings us all the way back to the beginning, which is what is IP? Because it sounds like you don't see your own drafting as itself a piece of art is afforded any protections.
Yeah.
And I find some irony to that, but also some intense practicality to that. Like, do you think about that as there's an art to writing a contract? Do you see it as a work of art?
I see it as a skill for sure. Like, I can remember how my brain worked before law school. A lot of people think law school is teaching you case law, which it does, but it rewrites your brain in the weirdest way, where you think of things different. Like, you genuinely think of problems different. You go through your thought analysis in a different way, and that's just the way they like just absolutely pile drive that into your way of thinking, and the way they do, and the way they teach you, and the way they do exams and stuff like that. But what's particularly interesting is actually contracts are not allowed to be copyright protected, because what an awful world we would live in where I wasn't allowed to use someone else's contract language to better my client's position. So that's actually a very specific exclusion to intellectual property protection, so that one person couldn't draft the ultimate perfect IP assignment language, and then like no one else was allowed to use it for 80 years or something. Like, that would be super dumb.
So it's not so, so much
it's actually explicitly.
It's not so much that we sort of agreed as a culture that this isn't art. It's like we agree that this is artful writing that would otherwise be protected, but we are going to carve out an exclusion for practical.
Because it would hurt society.
Yeah.
It would just like it would ultimately hurt everybody, because it would hurt lawyers who are trying to draft. It would hurt your clients who you're trying to protect. It would maybe help one super old lawyer back in the 1800s who was the first to draft up the good language, who's dead now. But like
the ultimate fair use.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's interesting that you called that out, because that's like one of the very few specific exclusions is like contracts, because otherwise my job would be, imagine I have to like verify that no one's ever said you hereby assign all right title and interest, or if that's public.
Oh boy.
I use that every day.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's getting down into the nitty gritty of like what is protectable. Like a word is, you can't copyright a word.
No.
You can copyright a sentence. Sometimes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like it's, and so yeah, just avoiding all of that in this area seems like the best idea.
Yeah, you'd like not only have an appendix, you would have to have footnotes or endnotes citing all of your sources.
Right.
Oh,
everyone gets a little cut.
Yeah.
And I will say, you can't copyright a word, but you can trademark a word.
Yes, a whole different area. And yeah, you mentioned
that's a whole different area.
Yeah, you mentioned that at the beginning. And like, I find that so fascinating. The, not just the topic, but the level of confusion people have about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, like when they see a Pepsi logo out in, like in a movie, they're like, is that copyright? It's like, well, not really, because that's the, like, you know, but maybe, like, I don't know. But I think that's outside the scope of what we're talking about today. We'll have to have you back to talk about trademark stuff, because I think it's really, really interesting. And patent stuff, which we didn't get into.
Right.
Like you say, is a much smaller area. And much, I think, more theoretical for a lot of people, certainly in the indie space.
Game mechanic patents are pissing me off, though. They're becoming worse.
Oh, yeah, because I always think hardware first, but.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, hardware I'm cool with. Hardware makes sense and it's supposed to be protected, but Nintendo and all these bigger companies filing all these mechanic patents is like, Someone who represents indie side is like, are we genuinely starting to have to do patent searches for gameplay? Because that's absolutely effing insane. I don't want to live in a world where that's a thing.
Yeah.
And it's like slowly becoming that way. And I just hate it.
Oof.
So I could rant about that if you ever want to rant about that in the future.
Yeah, because it's all a balance of concerns, right? It's like people deserve ownership over their unique works, but also like we all need to be able to work together in this industry. Mm-hmm. And so there's there's debate about what, you know, I imagine like copyright is probably the clearest, trademark is the least less, and then patents is probably the least explored area in terms of like precedents and stuff. Is that right?
For games, I would say, yeah. Like, there's way less things you can patent in games besides hardware, mm-hmm. Which is legit. Like, if you create a game engine that is wholly unique, is brand new, solves a problem, is awesome, mm-hmm. and you want to be able to market it on the marketplace for 20 years and have that monopoly, I'm like, hell yeah, that's a patent. That makes sense. If you want to patent, like, the way you throw a ball and catch something over there, that's not a... It's just they... Nintendo just has really good software patent drafters. They have really good software patenters that are getting these patents over the line that are essentially protecting the underlying idea of the game mechanic and not the execution of the software executing the mechanic within the gameplay, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So they'll say, we have this software that's really cool that does this thing. And I'm like, the thing is just throwing a ball. Is throwing a ball illegal now? Like, what the hell? It's just like, and then they're being really aggressive with it. It's also the fact that the patent offices aren't keeping up with that specific industry very well, in my opinion. They're not knowing, because you also can't patent something that already exists and already has happened in another game, say, for example. And are we really expecting the patent office to have played every video game ever to like know if that's happened or not?
Yeah.
If we're going to start protecting ideas behind mechanics, which is what they're doing, and not just like the software executing it. So, yeah, anyways, it makes me pissed off. I hate it.
Well, on that sour end note, I think condensed into this hour is, I think, a ton of practical information that I think people will have generally are always searching for and have the hardest time finding. So I really want to thank you, not just for presenting it, but presenting it in the way you did. Like,
yeah.
It was very illuminating. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me. I always like doing chats like this because it might maybe help somebody out there somewhere thinking about things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's our show. You can find Haley online at HaleyFax on socials and at her firm at voyerlaw.com. That's voyerlaw.com. For show notes and additional links from today's conversation, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes, delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be looking at friction by design and diversifying scoring. But that's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.